Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, delighted to welcome you to episode 2483 of The Tom Woods Show with Jonathan Newman, who is Henry Hazlitt Research Fellow at the Mises Institute. He is broadcasting from his office there. By the way, where are you in relation to Joe Salerno's office?
Oh, he's one office away from me. So it's me, then Mark Thornton, and then Joe Salerno.
So you're in my old office.
Oh, is that? Is that?
Yes.
Is that,
yeah, that's what I thought.
It's the office that Angie Napolitano used when he would visit.
Yeah, that's my old office. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Okay. All right. Well, glad it's being put to good use and no need to turn.
Big shoes to fill.
Oh, say again?
Big shoes to fill.
Oh, that's very kind. I mean, I wasn't expecting them to make it into a shrine to me or anything, but I did spend four very happy years in that particular office. So let's talk about why we're having this particular episode today. Mises has quite a list of publications, Ludwig von Mises, The Economist. And some of them are huge and can be difficult, and some are short and can be, if anything, too easy. And I've sometimes said that we need to have a kind of a middle-of-the-road text, and I think Sean Rittenour, with his collection of pieces, kind of did that. But the other day, one of these short books, which is a collection of lectures delivered by Mises in Argentina that really is intended for the general public, suddenly got some very unexpected attention, to the point where the Mises Institute sold out of its print copies and it's had like 50,000 downloads. Can you explain what this unexpected phenomenon is?
Yeah, so at the end of a UFC fight, and I haven't seen the fight, but you know, whenever somebody is going to be giving shout outs to Ludwig von Mises, then I'll start paying attention. But at the end of his fight, his name is Renato Moicano. He gave this excellent shout out to, and he was saying he loves capitalism, he loves America, he loves things like guns and the Bill of Rights that we have here in the U.S. But then at the end, he was encouraging everybody to go read Ludwig von Mises and learn about Austrian economics. And specifically, he told everybody to go read Mises's six lessons, the six lessons of Austrian economics. And so what he's referring to is the economic policy thoughts for today and tomorrow, the slender volume that you mentioned. And it was republished in Brazil under the title, The Six Lessons. And so, as you said, since he gave that sort of shout out, we've had a huge surge in interest for this book. And it's very interesting because I've been pushing for this book, especially for beginners, for months. And like just 1 week ago, I would have said it was an underappreciated book in Austrian economics, simply because it's a wonderful introduction to Mises' ideas, but it doesn't have the notoriety. But I'm really happy to see that it's finally picking up.
So I thought it would be a good sort of opportune moment to run through the six lessons and what they are. And I think this is useful for a number of reasons. It's useful for people who are just dipping their toes into all this. And I don't want to cater only to people who have been around forever and know all the lingo. But it's also a good refresher for those of us who have been around a while, because sometimes you just forget some of the arguments. Like I've forgotten, well, I don't have them in the back of me anymore. We moved them, but I used to have all my books on display and all the translations and stuff. And sometimes I pick up an old book that I myself wrote and I say, wow, what an interesting fact. Like I've completely forgotten what was in there. So it does repay the effort sometimes to go back and review what seem to be familiar texts, but are actually filled with all kinds of forgotten bits of wisdom. So lesson number one, so to speak, involves capitalism itself. So what are we supposed to learn here?
So Mises starts off the first lecture in the series of six lectures talking about how there was this huge explosion in economic growth and rises in standards of living, especially in countries where they were starting to accumulate capital and embrace free market ideas. And so he just talks through what were the factors that allowed that to happen. And like I said, he very importantly, stress capital accumulation. So the way that countries can grow, the way that they can start to expand worker productivity is by first saving and investing. And only by saving and investing can you put new capital goods, new machines, tools, new technologies, can you start to implement those in production and start the mass production that we see in economic history that corresponded with the Industrial Revolution. So he said that the capital accumulation was the most important thing, but he also was talking about how there was this emergence of big businesses. And even though we oftentimes hear the term big business as sort of like an insult or like a negative thing. He was showing how there was this refocusing of business away from just making luxury items for the elites, just for the leaders of the country so that they could purchase those luxury items. But there was this refocusing away from just producing those types of goods and producing things that the masses would enjoy. So there was this mass of potential consumers and population was increasing as well. And so those businesses realized that they could make more money by producing things that everybody wanted, not just, you know, some select few. So it was a combination of those sorts of factors that allowed capitalism to arise and make it possible for people to have standards of living that they had never dreamed of before.
And these days, Jonathan, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I feel like when we think back to like the two Ron Paul presidential campaigns of the 21st century anyway, that we were just on fire with excitement about Austrian economics and the market economy. But these days, it's like everybody's down on the market economy, including people on the right wing. Like they've got 27 criticisms or they think it's responsible for this, that, or the other thing. So it sounds like kind of quaintly naive to be out there defending capitalism now. It's not as in vogue as it was, let's say, when we were edgy Ron Paulians. Now, is that just me or do you also sense that?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. One thing that Mises talks about in the book is how the sort of anti-market, anti-capitalistic mentality is sometimes how he refers to it. It's a minority view. It's not something that is representative of the masses. And now sometimes the masses of people, they're not as loud as the intellectuals that are providing all of these diatribes against the capitalist system. But Mises found a lot of hope in the fact that it was just this like sort of small minority of elites and intellectuals that were advocating for, you know, socialism, Keynesianism, Marxism, those sorts of things. But Mises points out that freedom, prosperity, the prosperity that comes from capitalism is something that is popular, and the ideas and the outcomes of the market economy is something that appeals to a large mass of people. And so that's what Mises found hope in, and that's something that he touches on at the very end of the book.
All right, let's go on ahead to the second lesson. The second lesson involves socialism. Now, the thing is that sometimes with discussions of socialism, you get bogged down in defining it, you know, defining what socialism is, and then, well, socialism used to mean this, and now it means that. So at least in the context of this particular section of this particular book, what are we talking about when we mean a socialist system?
Mises is really good at taking down socialism because in his book that's called Socialism, he addresses all of the different flavors of socialism because, you know, there's all these different ways that socialists dream up of how they would implement their utopia, their ideal system. But what Mises points out is that there's something that's similar to all of the different flavors of socialism, and that is that the means of production, the private ownership of the means of production is abolished, which is why Mises' critique of socialism is so powerful. Not just that it's theoretically powerful, but that it applies to all of those different versions of socialism. So for Mises, socialism is whenever entrepreneurs can't use economic calculation simply because there's no prices for factors of production, because there's no private ownership of those factors of production. So there's a few steps there, but it's a very simple and straightforward argument. But what's interesting in this book is Mises doesn't spend a lot of time talking about his famous economic calculation critique. He actually, since he was talking to a more popular audience when he was giving these lectures in Argentina, he spends a lot of this lecture just talking about how socialism is the same thing as a system of slavery, since it's top-down commands. It's the government or some small group in a socialist planning board deciding what everybody is going to do and what's going to be produced and what goods and services people can enjoy. So I think Mises was adapting his rhetoric for this audience. And I think it worked out well for him because he was able to talk about in capitalism, when we have economic freedom, people can choose their own careers. There's a certain level of social mobility where somebody can start off poor if they have a great idea of how to produce something more efficiently or have an idea of what consumers will demand in the future, then they can actually emerge out of that status and become very successful financially and economically speaking. Whereas that sort of opportunity doesn't exist in alternative systems like socialism and feudalism. It's really only later in the lecture that he brings up what economists would consider as the you know, the knockout punch against socialism, the economic calculation critique.
Right, right, right. Which I'm sure I've done episodes on that. So do a search at tomwoods.com for economic calculation, or maybe Mises.org just might have the odd article or two on that, that subject. So, all right, let's talk about interventionism. With interventionism, you have a market society, but you also have an entity that is intervening in that society and that is substituting arbitrary political whim for what people would voluntarily choose to do otherwise. And you say in your article, I can't even remember if I mentioned at the beginning that you wrote a piece that I want to make sure I link to at the episode is 2483. So I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2483. Also in the video description for those good souls watching on video, given that all of a sudden this thing was getting all this attention, you wrote a kind of a summary of the six different lessons. So in this case, you cite Mises talking about a price ceiling on milk, and you think, well, milk's kind of expensive, so if we have a price ceiling on milk, then those terrible price gougers won't be able to overcharge, quote-unquote, for milk, and this will benefit the general public. And that's as far as a lot of people can see. It's as far as a lot of people can take the analysis, but we know, even not even from purely Austrian economics, but just economics 101, that that's not the end of the discussion. So what is?
Mises does a really good job of showing how interventionism is not just this sort of innocuous middle ground between capitalism and socialism. So a lot of people think, yeah, capitalism is great. We get all this expanded production. Socialism has its flaws. Capitalism has its flaws, but they also have some advantages as well. Some people might say this sort of thing. And so they might, you know, come to the what they see as the middle, which is we need some free markets, but, you know, every now and then the government has to step in and fix things, set certain prices, protect domestic producers with tariffs. And so that's what Mises terms interventionism. And with the example of the price ceiling on milk that you were referring, Mises was walking through just a very simple example that shows how if the government decides to decide what the maximum price of milk is, then there's all of these unintended consequences. So they think that they can just, you know, set the price and that's the end of it. But as you said, there's all of these other things that happen. So at the lower price, there's increased demand. There's less incentive to sell simply because of the shape of supply and demand curves. But that even that's not the end of it. Because if you prevent the price from going too high, it means that we're not going to have price as the rationing factor. So people who are just able to get to the store first, who might have a lower willingness to pay, they might not have the highest value use for milk, they're going to be the ones who get the milk as opposed to people who would have been able to get it if it was an unregulated market. Anyway, the point is that there's all of these unintended consequences, and it becomes apparent to both the people at large, but also the government. It becomes clear that the government's intended effect is not occurring. There's all of these negative outcomes, including the one thing that they wanted to happen, which is to make milk more available to people. And so what does the government do in response to that? Well, they see that people don't really like the way that the price control was implemented in the first place. And so instead of just getting rid of the price control, the government doubles down and they start implementing price controls on the factors of production. And so Mises mentions cow fodder, so cattle feed, as one of the factors of production that goes into making milk. And so they implement price controls there. And you have all of the same issues when that price control is implemented, which means that's further grounds for the government to continue to intervene. And so the end result here is that the government just starts intervening anywhere and everywhere. And so you actually get totalitarianism or you get socialism. Even one small little intervention in the market economy leads to this tendency for the government to just take over everything. So far from it being just this sort of middle of the road policy that gets some of the advantages from this side and some of the advantages from that side and none of the disadvantages, it just tends toward the socialist side. It tends toward the government taking over everything.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, and I'm looking forward to seeing you very soon at my Practical Liberty Unconference in June 2024, this very year, just a couple months from now. Practical Liberty, because we're not going to be doing any abstract libertarian theorizing. We're not going to be debating how we would apply Lockean homesteading theory to outer space or what libertarians should think about consensual cannibalism. No, no, no. None of that stuff. Instead, it's going to be all practical things. We're going to be talking about practical things that you need to know in order to survive under a hostile regime, which is indeed what we live under. And it's an unconference because, you know, you go to a conference, you sit through a whole lot of talks, and, you know, to be perfectly honest, you're really only interested in two or three of them. You got to just sit through the whole thing. There isn't going to be any sitting through anything. On the Saturday of the conference, we're all going to talk to each other. How about that for a novel idea? We're going to break into separate rooms, and people will lead discussions on all kinds of topics, 25 minutes at a time. You can speak on anything you want, or you can just listen. So we'll have a business room where people can discuss or ask questions about or get feedback on any business topic. We'll have a room on personal development so people can talk about how they lost 50 pounds or the three tactics they used to overcome procrastination or how they became 20% more productive. We'll have another room talking about parallel institutions like monetary institutions like Bitcoin or educational institutions like homeschooling, whatever else you can think of. And if you have better ideas than these, we'll consider those too. Everybody's going to leave with exciting new ideas and new friends and connections. Not to mention, we will conclude our event with a brand new show from the outstanding world-class magician Doc Dixon, who is 100% one of us and top-notch. He fooled Penn and Teller on their Fool Us television show. We'll also be joined by our old friend Jeff Deist. It's going to be a fantastic time. Check it out at tomwoods.com/unconference. And you can bring a plus one for free. That's tomwoods.com/unconference. Well, I think maybe the topic of the most direct application to ordinary people these days is the fourth one on inflation. So first of all, I mean, I guess we probably do need to define what inflation is according to somebody like Mises. But then let's also talk about how he conceptualizes what's going on when we have price inflation, that it's not that, well, there's been an increase in the money supply, and then the next day, there's that percentage-wise increase in all the prices. What exactly happens?
Mises has, I think, the best views on inflation and how inflation is used by governments and why governments use inflation. So he talks about how there's really only two or sometimes three ways that governments can raise funds to do all of their spending, to do all of their intervening. And that's taxes, borrowing, and then printing money. And so Mises goes through an example where the government would like to build a hospital, and he shows that if the government taxes first to pay for the hospital, then there's a replacement of spending. So the government takes some money away from the tax base and then uses it to spend on the hospital. So there's some spending potential that was taken away from the population, and then it was replaced by the government deciding to spend money to build the hospital. But in the case where the government decides to print money to build the hospital, it means that there's no replacement of spending. It means that all of the citizens still have the same ability to spend, but now the government also has this additional ability to spend. And so what you get is this tendency for prices to rise. Now, one reason why Mises is great on monetary matters is because he didn't stop there. He didn't just say, oh, prices tend to rise, therefore all prices will rise simultaneously and proportionally, almost like a sea level going up. But what happens in the real world is that we have these like step-by-step processes where the first time new money is spent into the economy, those prices increase, and the people who sold those goods have their incomes increase, which means they can now increase their demands for goods and services, which means that those prices rise. So we get this picture, it's almost like a rippling, like you toss a rock into a still pond and you see the rippling out effect of that initial cause. And that's exactly what happens when we have monetary inflation. The new money is spent into the economy at a particular point, which means some people get the ability to increase their demands for goods and services first. And then as the money ripples out, there's people on the outskirts who don't get the money until later. They have fixed incomes, or maybe their incomes rise last. And so they have to start paying all these higher prices before everyone else. And so the reason why this observation is so important is because it actually describes why governments want to inflate. So if we didn't have these, they're called Cantillon effects, if we didn't have this unevenness, then there would actually be no reason for the government to print money in the first place. So if it were possible for all prices to rise as soon as the new money was printed, there'd be no incentive to make money in the first place. So then the next step is to realize that whenever the government is increasing the money supply in this way, it's so that they can extract resources from the private economy.
Okay, let me intervene because I want to make sure everybody is seeing that that's actually one of the most important points I think anybody has made on this show in several months. So it's, either I've had a boring run for several months or this is a very important point. So I want to make sure people are understanding that because if indeed the result of increasing the money supply, let's say by 100%, was simply that all prices went up by 100%, well then, okay, that doesn't really benefit or hurt anybody because ultimately everything, like that would include your wages and whatever, everything would just be, all right, I have the same purchasing power I had before. Things mathematically, like they add up to different sums, but the purchasing power I have is unchanged. Everything has gone up equally. So there'd be no point in doing it in the first place. The reason they do it is specifically to benefit some groups at the expense of others. And the only way that can happen is if some prices rise and some prices fall differently from others. If it were all identical, it would just all be a wash. There'd be no reason to do it. The reason they're doing it is for the specific purpose of rewarding a constituency and or punishing other people or just being indifferent to other people. That is essential. And I'm sorry I cut you off, but that just goes to show that sometimes revisiting these old books, you uncover arguments that you forgot about. I forgot about that. That's a great point.
There's one extra tidbit here. And so another reason why governments like inflation as opposed to taxation is, number one, taxes are unpopular. So if the government says, hey, we're going to build this new hospital, and then they say, we're going to raise taxes, then there'd be a bunch of grumbling from the taxpayers. But if instead they use money printing, I mean, just in my explanation and in your explanation, you'll notice that it takes a few steps to think it through. You have to think about it for a second to realize what's going on. And the effects of inflation are delayed. So they're complex and delayed, which is why there's not as much uproar about money printing as there is with taxation, even though the reason why governments are doing it is the same. It's we're trying to extract resources from the private economy.
All right. So that's inflation. What's the, now I'm asking you to do this from memory. Do you remember what the fifth one is?
Oh, well, lucky for me, I have it pulled up right here. Yeah.
There you go.
It's foreign investment. So in this foreign investment lecture, Mises was talking about how one way that we can speed up the capital accumulation that's required to bring about economic growth is to allow some countries to invest in other countries. And there's often a lot of distaste for this because there's all this balance of trade stuff and people can talk about unfavorable versus favorable balances of trade. But what Mises shows is that there's no such thing as an unfavorable balance of trade. So he gives the example of the British investing in rail system infrastructure in the United States. So when the British did that, yeah, the British owned the capital, they owned the equity in the rail companies that were created with the British investment. And so that's like an unfavorable balance of trade from the US point of view. But what that capital infusion from the British did is it increased the productivity within the United States. So workers in the United States become more productive, their real wages increase, and then you actually get to a point where United States citizens get the ability to purchase the stock if they want to, purchase the stock from the British owners. And so there's never this case where there's like this one-sided, where one country has to like provide this one-sided sacrifice to another country in order for the other country to benefit. If you just allow free movement of capital across boundaries, then you get mutually beneficial capital accumulation. And it's good for the British. It's good for the Americans.
And then, by the way, that's an unpopular thing in a lot of circles because people think of foreign investment as some kind of exploitation somehow. But it really is a shortcutting of a process that's otherwise very laborious and potentially time-consuming.
Yeah, and Mises talks about what you're mentioning, the distaste. For some reason, people don't like this. And he talks about the sorts of things that can get in the way of it. So whenever you have protectionist policies being put in or tariffs, and Mises actually points out like the worst thing that could happen would be a war, especially world wars, because then you have the domestic government will just expropriate. They'll just take that capital away from the foreign investors. And we've actually seen some of that in the past few years. And so that just puts a total halt to foreign investment, which means that it's going to totally halt the process by which we get economic growth. So Mises was very aware of the debate and of the ideas surrounding it. And he was saying that all the things that are done to try to fix the problems that people see and just make it worse for everybody.
Yeah, I think that insight is what drove me for so many years to go around trying my best to explain things, because I would want to say to people, you're just making things worse for yourself. All the things you're advocating, you're just making things worse for yourself. And not to mention, you're making them worse for me too, which is even worse. But you're certainly not helping yourself with the things you think are going to help you. And then finally, we're down to politics and ideas, which is fairly broad. Where's he going here?
So here he sort of zooms out and he talks about the way that the philosophy of free markets and free people started, and the authors that were promoting it. So he points to a lot of the 18th and 19th century philosophers who were talking about classical liberal ideas. And he showed how the popularity of those ideas led to more constrained governments and the expansion of business and economic growth that he detailed in the first lecture. So obviously, Mises was giving this lecture in the 20th century, and the 20th century was, you know, by far not a very good example of the propagation of classical liberal ideas and ideals, because we had world wars, we had tons of interventionism, socialism was tried in a bunch of different locations. And so Mises was trying to unpack how that happened. How do we get such a good start from those philosophers and early economists? How do we start so well, but then end up basically destroying what had been handed down to us in the history of ideas? And he points to two things. He points to the resurgence of the warlike spirit. That's a direct quote from Mises. So not just nationalism, but the idea that we need to wage war and spread our empire and police what's going on in other parts of the world, basically use the military to get what we want. So he points to the resurgence of the warlike spirit, but he also talks about special interest groups, and he uses a term called pressure groups. In his discussion of pressure groups, he was talking about how the groups that would be benefited in the short run by some government intervention sometimes can get the ear of a politician, which causes the politician to discard the interests of the people that they represent and instead enact legislation, regulations, policies that would benefit that particular group. So since politicians were sort of, I get the idea of like a worm tongue in Lord of the Rings, they were sort of listening to these lobbyists and enacting these sorts of interventions, that led to the process that he described in the earlier lecture, where one intervention begets another intervention to the point where we get totalitarianism. So it's those two things, it's the warlike spirit and also the pressure groups that are sort of turning the governments away from classical liberalism and towards totalitarianism.
You know, these days, as I said, it's like nobody really wants to defend the old freedom of commerce and the old kind of societies that we advocated for. And sometimes you get this sense that, well, since the left is using the state to ram through what it wants, it's time for us to do the same. And in terms of at least how that applies to economics, I still don't see how you're doing anything other than hurting yourself by intervening. You could say, well, at the local level, if we're going to have schools, they're not going to teach crazy ideologies. I'm on board for that. But it's like, I think some people are throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You still want a private property society, and you still want freedom of commerce, and you still want to minimize the role of the state. You're not going to get what you want. You're not going to get what you want if you're going to try to override that.
Yeah, one of the common themes in all of Mises' writing, and also in this little book, is the mutual benefit that's in the market economy. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. If we wanted to like override what the left is doing by doing our own sorts of interventions, then that's just going to lead down the same path that Mises was talking about with the price ceiling on milk. So just because we sort of change the direction or change which groups are impacted by some policy, it doesn't mean that we're going to get this, you know, massive victory for freedom and liberty-loving people. What's going to happen is we're just going to get more of that trajectory towards totalitarianism. So I'm fully on board with what you're saying.
Tell me what's going on at the Mises Institute these days.
One thing that I'd like to promote is our book clubs. So one thing that we've started recently is getting a small group of undergraduate students to read and discuss books that we select. And so we've done a book club on For New Liberty, which I led. And there was also a virtual book club on The Road to Serfdom that was led by Tate Fegley. And coincidentally, and it is a pure coincidence, we actually selected Economic Policy Thoughts for Today and Tomorrow as the next book to be studied in the book club that's going to be in the summer. So if you're an undergraduate student out there and you're interested in reading this book and discussing it with a Mises scholar, his name is Karis Lambert. He's over in Japan, excellent scholar. Then I highly recommend that you check it out. Just go to Mises.org and go over to the events page and you'll see it listed there.
Excellent. So Mises.org/events. Of course, we all know that's Mises.org/events. So check that out. I'll be speaking at the Mises Institute Supporters Summit in October, which will be a lot of fun. I had to miss last year as it coincided with something else I was doing, but I'll be glad to be back. And Jonathan, thanks so much for your time. We're going through some of these building blocks of Misesian economics and social thought at a time when they got some surprising attention. So thank you very much.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.